This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Once upon a time, in the long-ago world of high school reading, on a hilltop far, far away, Holden Caulfield was perhaps the epitome of angst, a young man suddenly an outcast in the world he thought he knew. J.D. Salinger's antihero was about to enter a perilous journey of self-discovery. Today, down from the hilltop, high school English teachers may identify with Holden because reading scores for American students have dropped precipitously. How much? David Coleman, president of the College Board, says it's alarming.
We have a crisis in the country around remediation rates. What I mean by that is so many kids, often as many as 50%, graduate high school in this country visibly, demonstrably not ready for the demands of a first-year college course or a career training program, which means they enter remediation courses in college for which they don't get credit, and that's often a path to not completing college, particularly for low-income children.
David Coleman is the lead architect of the Common Core, a sweeping new curricular change which integrates nonfiction into the English program. Only one problem. Where does it leave the catcher in the rye? That's our cover story today. Fiction, nonfiction, and the great debate. The Common Core is an ambitious realignment of school curricula. With remarkable unity, it's been touted by the Obama administration and Republicans and by the two largest teachers' unions. States receive federal money to opt in, and only four states have not. At the heart of the debate, though, is the requirement over exactly how fiction will fare in this brave new world. By the last couple years of high school, 70% of what students will be reading across all subjects must be nonfiction. I asked David Coleman what this achieves.
Fiction remains at the heart of the Common Core standards in English language arts classrooms. For example, Shakespeare is twice required. There's a focus on American literature. What changes instead is that high-quality nonfiction becomes an essential part of the history and social studies curriculum, as well as science and technical subjects. Within English language arts, the only shift is that there's some entry of high-quality literary nonfiction, such as the founding documents and the great conversation they inspired. The idea is that things like Lincoln's second inaugural, Martin Luther King's magnificent letter from Birmingham jail, these documents are worthy of close attention, not just in a historical context, but also for the interweaving of thought and language. And in that way, they're appropriate for studying English language arts as well.
I don't think anyone would disagree that a letter from Birmingham jail isn't an important historical document. But I wanted to ask, when those are incorporated into the English class, isn't this something that students should actually be required to read in either history or American studies or social studies?
The idea is that in English language arts, there's a wonderful attention paid not only to the historical impact of such a work, but its use of language, the expression of language through rhetoric. And so what English teachers throughout this country, as well as other teachers, talk to us about is for kids to be ready for the demands of college and career, they should attentively read literature and understand the force of language in that context, to convey ideas, to debate them, to distill them. That is also a part of the essential work of preparation and a wonderful part of the force of the English language.
How will you know, as a person who has developed this curricula, if it's working?
I think if the Common Core standards are successful, we should see a world in which remediation rates at colleges, in other words, where kids enter college after receiving a high school degree and still need remediation, we need those rates to go down. So that would be a visible victory. In this country, for the past 40 years, the scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress in reading in eighth grade have been flat. If we can't have a breakthrough in this country in reading performance, particularly in later grades, so many students will be consigned to a world where they can't read the texts in front of them and hence grow and learn. So success in performance terms would look like breakthroughs in those areas of achievement. Those aren't happen in a moment, but over time.
That's David Coleman, the lead architect behind new guidelines. Before the Common Core, most high school English classes read mostly literature. The reality now is that students must split their time between fiction and nonfiction. There are even some school districts where teachers have been asked to drop novels to meet the new requirements. And that's exactly what Azar Nafisi is afraid of. Nafisi is the author of the critically acclaimed Reading Lolita in Tehran, a nonfiction book. In Iran, she used Western literature to challenge autocratic thinking. Now, she's worried that in America, the great novels will inevitably be sacrificed.
Imaginative knowledge is a way of perceiving the world, relating to the world, and changing the world, and nothing can replace it. So where I disagree with Mr. Coleman is trying to replace fiction with nonfiction rather than finding creative ways of teaching students a very creative interdisciplinary program where you could teach them side by side and focus on quality rather than on bringing about these sort of changes.
And according to Nafisi, the value of getting lost in a really good novel can't be overstated.
When you look at a documentary or read a real life story, you can understand the experiences that that person went through. When you read Zora Neale Hurston, you not only understand that particular person's experiences, but you also are able to empathize and become that person. You put yourself in that person's mind and heart. And so the experience is completely different. And that is why I think from time immemorial, human beings have had the need to understand the world through telling the story.
Writer Azar Nafisi, her new book called Dispatches from the Republic of Imagination, talks about the necessity of fiction. However, almost the entire country, 46 states and Washington, D.C., have already signed on to the Common Core. While some states won't adopt the guidelines for several years, others already have. Kentucky was the first. Angela Gunter teaches English at Davis County High School in Owensboro. Gunter says that at first, many of her colleagues opposed the changes.
As you can imagine, we English teachers love our literature, and the greater emphasis on nonfiction text was uncomfortable for some of us.
Now Gunter says her students actually like it. She kept them in the loop the whole way, beginning by showing them their own reading level scores.
When they realized how relatively low they were, it was a really wake-up call for them. They were very upset, and I told them they should feel like they had been cheated. They've not been taught this, and we understood at that point that we needed to start challenging the students more.
Take, say, To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a novel, she says, with deceptively simple language.
However, there are so many themes that are much more complex that require mature thinking that we want to keep it at the high school level. So we paired it with Malcolm Gladwell's piece, which alleges that it's an elitist story, and the kids have never heard that. So the students find that there's a purpose in the reading that may not have been as apparent before.
The downside?
We can't read everything. We can't fit everything in. So we have had to deal with abridging a bit.
Take Shakespeare. Instead of reading all five acts of Julius Caesar, her freshmen now read only the speeches delivered by Brutus and Mark Antony after Caesar's execution, rather than reading the play as a whole. And that's the problem, according to Mark Bauerling. He's an English professor at Emory University. A few years ago, he helped the team developing the Common Core. But he eventually parted ways with David Coleman, mainly because he disagrees with the attempts to standardize learning. Mark Bauerling says the standards pile so much onto English teachers that the cultivation of critical, passionate reading is in jeopardy.
When you interpret these standards at the state level, when you try to develop lesson plans, when you select works to be assigned, when you find the assignments that people have, one can interpret those so broadly that we actually end up with a lot of weak practices.
So what happens to the classic novels, Mark Bauerling, when we're reducing the amount of fiction students are reading? Is that a concern?
It is a concern. Now, the Common Core has a wonderful standard for 11th and 12th grade English, which runs demonstrate knowledge of 18th, 19th, and early 20th century foundational works of American literature. But you've got so many other pressures on English teachers in Common Core, the teaching of writing, of nonfiction text, you have research skills that they're supposed to develop. And the problem is that all those classics, they take a lot of time, especially in the hustling, bustling, hyper-digital world of 17-year-olds. I worry that we're just going to find that teachers will teach shorter works, they will spend less time on those classics, and they'll tend to orient them more toward topical, relevant concerns.
Do you think that students and teachers will both in some ways evaluate the entire experience of literature quite differently, so that they're reading with some sort of purpose to fit a curriculum and perhaps, oh, I just want to fall into the world of this novel, maybe getting left out.
The sort of free-floating, open-ended, literary, intellectual experience simply is hard to fit into the achievement orientation and the accountability system. So if the English class does not hold the line against the kid who has a curiosity, who is really struck by Quentin Compson in The Sound and the Fury, the kid who gets taken up with Ivan Karamazov in The Brothers Karamazov, that bright kid who's having issues with atheism or with despair, things that happen often during those years, well, that area in which you want to cultivate the intellect of that thoughtful 18-year-old who often isn't oriented toward grades, but who often ends up being the kind of thoughtful intelligence that ends up doing something extraordinary 10 years later, are we losing the support or at least the conditions that will prompt that student to continue reading and thinking?
That's Mark Bauerlein, an English professor at Emory University and an opponent of the Common Core State Standards. You're listening to NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and now a train ride to a fabled destination which marks its 100th birthday on February 2nd.
Pillsbury Snow Sheen Cake Flour brings you Grand Central Station.
That's a fictional version of our subject, complete with an inaccurate title, we'll explain that in a moment. With a breathlessness that only old-time radio could manage, this show focused on a grandiose rail hub in the heart of Manhattan.
As a bullet seeks its target, shining rails in every part of our great country are aimed at Grand Central Station, heart of the nation's greatest city. Drawn by the magnetic force of the fantastic metropolis, day and night, great trains rush toward the Hudson River, sweep down its eastern bank for 140 miles, flash briefly by the long red row of tenement houses south of 125th Street, dive with a roar into the 2.5 mile tunnel which burrows beneath the glitter and swank of Park Avenue, and then Grand Central Station.
In real life these days, it's a little less dramatic than that.
May I ask, from which track is the Bridgeport?
Got that 207 track 19.
Well, I've got a ticket for the 230-something. Could I take the 207?
You can take either one of them. The 207 leaves first. The next one is that 234 track 105.
That's information booth officer Audrey Johnson Gordon at her post in the center of the terminal's main concourse under a great four-sided clock.
Yes, sir.
Greenwich, Connecticut?
Track 102A downstairs.
102A?
Uh-huh.
Thanks.
So what are the most common questions you're asked here at the information booth?
One lady wanted to know if she went outside of Grand Central, how much would it cost to come back in?
Uh-huh.
I said, I'll be at the door.
That obviously was unusual.
Very unusual.
A more common request? Where's the Apple Store?
Where's the Apple Store and where's the bathroom? Mm-hmm. And how do I get out of here?
That's really not such a strange question. There are passages and ramps, restaurants and stores, subway connections and more passages. And it is, after all, a temple of transit full of people going somewhere else in a hurry. A new book tells the story of this majestic place. It's called Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. Its author is New York Times reporter Sam Roberts. Roberts tells the story of the rapacious robber baron Cornelius Vanderbilt, who built it for his railroad, the story of the long-forgotten William Wilgus, who figured out that the trains had to be electrified, and the story of how the historic preservation movement got underway to save the place from the wrecking ball that had claimed New York's Penn Station. When we met Sam Roberts outside Audrey Gordon's information booth, we first dispensed with that widely ignored bit of Grand Central pedantry, that it is Grand Central Terminal, not Grand Central Station. It was originally called a depot, and then when passengers used to continue downtown on horse-drawn trains, it was a station.
And finally, in 1913, it became a terminal because the trains terminated here.
But I just took the subway here from the west side, and the shuttle says Grand Central Station.
It does, and in fact, there are two Grand Central Stations. There is a Grand Central Station on the subway, and there is also a Grand Central Station that's the post office. But this is officially, although I think most New Yorkers probably don't know it for sure, this is Grand Central Terminal.
The depot was there for decades before 1913. What forced construction of Vanderbilt's palatial terminal was a catastrophic underground train crash in 1902.
A fatal accident of commuter trains, a train coming out of the tunnel under Park Avenue, under steam control, couldn't see because of the steam, the cinders, the heat, the fog, the snow, and wound up crashing into another train with multiple fatalities. And the railroad, if not the politicians who licensed it, in effect said, we can't go on with this anymore, we've got to make a change, otherwise we're going to ban your railroad from Manhattan. So instead they switched to electricity, which allowed them to get rid of the steam, get rid of the smoke, build the two-level station for incoming and outgoing trains, and deck over Park Avenue and create some of the most valuable real estate in the world.
As Sam Roberts tells it, that phrase that he just used a moment ago, commuter train, owes its life to a Mr. Sloat, a superintendent on Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad, who back in the 19th century came up with a brilliant marketing scheme and an unusual word for it.
He noticed that lots of people from Westchester, from Connecticut, were taking the train back and forth. So instead of charging the full fare, they decided they would commute the fare, much like, I guess, you would commute someone's sentence if they were on death row. But that's how commuter, the term, was actually born.
As Sam Roberts recounts its story, Grand Central gave us the principle of air rights when it created Park Avenue over what had been an open train yard and people built on top of railroad property. It effectively gave New York Midtown Manhattan, the heart of the city used to be farther downtown. It also epitomized innovation 100 years ago. With trains making long-distance trips in those days, people had lots of luggage that had to be moved onto the trains by cart, hence all those ramps.
And when these ramps opened, they were a real innovation at Grand Central Terminal because the place has virtually no staircases. People realized that particularly long-distance travelers were coming in with suitcases, lots of luggage, and the ramps were built to accommodate them. Lots of people didn't know what a ramp was, interestingly enough. So there was one explanation that pointed out that the word comes from ramparts.
So where are we now?
We now walked up from the lower level to the upper level, the main concourse level, without going up one step.
And when Grand Central Terminal opened in 1913, it was virtually a massive advertisement for electricity and for the Vanderbilts.
Look around you and look at all those bare electric light bulbs.
Yeah.
You wonder why they were not more ornate lighting fixtures. It's because they were showing off electricity. This was the first electric terminal, both the tracks and the lighting of the whole terminal itself. And if you look very carefully on some of the finer artwork, you will see lots of acorns and oak leaves. The acorn and the oak leaf was on the Vanderbilt family crest. You know, little acorns, mighty oaks like the Vanderbilts grew, and they had an enormous influence on the development of this terminal.
Grand Central is home to commuter trains these days. No more luxury train to Chicago like the one Cary Grant took in North by Northwest.
Give me a bedroom on the 20th Century, please.
Leaving in 5 minutes.
Yes, I know. Could you make a snap in?
I think they're all sold out.
The 20th Century was the train for which they literally rolled out a red carpet every time it boarded. Another Grand Central contribution to the lexicon. Grand Central is such a bright open space, with at least one original tenant left, the famed Oyster Bar, and so many other amenities. You can sympathize with the woman whom Audrey Johnson Gordon at the information booth talked about, the woman who asked, "Do you have to pay to get in?" Sam Roberts thinks it's a bargain.
It is like being in a cathedral. It's like being in an art museum. And to think this is something that's being made available to the public at large, not for an elite group of people, but anyone who wants to travel anywhere can walk into Grand Central and partake of it. That's a great New York City institution.
Well, Sam Roberts, author of Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America, thank you very much for talking
Robert,
with us.
Robert, thank you for inviting me.
210 Stanford Local. This train will be exceeding passengers.
Until next week, this is your Grand Central Station narrator, Ken Roberts, saying goodbye, and for better baking, better buy Pillsbury, greatest name in flour.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Everyone has relationship problems, and I mean everyone.
On the first day, God created the heavens and the earth. Let there be light, he said, and there was light. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, the first night. On the second day, God separated the oceans from the sky. Let there be a horizon, he said. And lo, a horizon appeared. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, the second night. On the third day, God's girlfriend came over and said he'd been acting distant lately. I'm sorry, God said. Things have been crazy this week at work. He smiled at her, but she did not smile back. And God saw that it was not good. I never see you, she said. That's not true, God said. We went to the movies just last week. And she said, lo, that was last month. And there was evening. A tense night.
Now, when you're in conversation with people, when you're really serious, do you just say, lo?
I love lo. I think lo is underused. I don't know how that fell by the wayside.
I know. So I'm glad you're bringing it back. Simon Rich's latest book is called The Last Girlfriend on Earth. He joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Simon, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the book is divided into three parts. Boy meets girl is the first part. Boy gets girl. Boy loses girl. Are you trying to tell us something about your personal life, Simon?
It is a pretty honest and personal book, which is a strange thing to say about a book that's filled with so much time travel and rocket ships and talking trolls and magical goats. But it is actually a pretty honest book.
Is that a safe place for you to find comedic fodder in romantic relationships, in personal relationships? All joking aside, those can be serious, often painful places to explore in your own psyche.
I always try to write about the highest stakes. I'm in my late 20s. And I think most people in their 20s, dating is about as high stakes as it gets. And trying to write about these experiences that we've all had, these experiences of falling in love and losing someone and wanting someone and getting dumped or having to dump someone, it only felt natural to write about them in these extreme, bizarre, high stakes arenas like science fiction and horror and crime, because when you're living through it, it does feel about as extreme as things can get.
You come from a family of writers. How old were you when you decided to start writing?
I've wanted to write as long as I can remember. When I was five, all I wanted to do was write like Roald Dahl. I read his stories obsessively, and I just wanted to copy him and rip him off as much as possible. And that's still all I do, is sit in a room trying to rip off Roald Dahl as much as humanly possible.
What specifically inspired you about his writing, and what have you kind of latched onto personally that you try to replicate?
I've always been attracted to premise writers, people who hook you really fast and don't let you go. Guys like Roald Dahl and T.C. Boyle and Stephen King, not necessarily even comedy writers, just people who snare you with a story you can't put down. That's really always been my goal as a writer, is more than anything, is just to write something that people will want to finish voluntarily.
There is one story in here that we'd love if you could just read a little bit of. This piece is called Magical Mr. Goat. The main character of the story is a young girl named Olivia. Can you tell us about her?
This is sort of my Victorian story. There's a young, imaginative girl trapped in the country estate with her governess and forced to eat Marmite and learn sums, and she wishes something exciting would happen, and lo and behold, a magical talking goat pops through her mirror, and they have adventures together and become close friends, and then it takes a turn. "Zerkity zerks," Mr. Goat cried. "What a wonderful, sunderful day." He got on all fours, and Olivia hopped on his back. "Giddy up," she cried. "At your service, m'lady." She laughed as he barreled down the staircase and out the door, galloping willy-nilly across the grass. After a time, they collapsed in a meadow at the edge of the estate. They lay on the soft earth, laughing uproariously amid the wildflowers. "Oh, Mr. Goat," Olivia cried. "The last few days have been ever so much fun." Mr. Goat leaned in and kissed her. "Whoa," Olivia said. "What was that?" Mr. Goat flushed with embarrassment. "I'm sorry," he stammered. "I thought..." "Well, you thought wrong," Olivia said. "We're just friends, okay?"
Poor Mr. Goat.
This is a story based on an experience that I think a lot of young men have had, and young women, where you're in what you think is a very good, fun, stable, platonic friendship, and then ultimately it turns out that one of the people in that friendship have ulterior motives.
You were one of the youngest writers to ever write for Saturday Night Live, which is a really big deal. What was that like? I mean, just walking around the halls and, like, you're collaborating with Bill Hader and Andy Samberg and all these amazing people. That had to have been a complete trip.
It was really fun. I grew up watching Saturday Night Live, and it was really surreal to actually physically be there. It did feel, on some nights, like you'd walked into a TV screen, you know, like you were living in this alternate reality. And it was really high pressure, but I liked the rhythm of it, throwing out 50, 100 sketches a year and seeing what'll stick. That's how I write books, too. You know, for The Last Girlfriend on Earth, there's 30 pieces in the book. I can't even imagine how many I must have written that didn't make the cut, at least 100 beyond that.
Would you mind reading us out on page 178?
Yeah, this is a personal ad. You. You are an intelligent woman with a sweet and caring soul. You're mature and sophisticated, but you know how to let loose and have a good time. Your first name is Chloe. Me. I am a thoughtful, intelligent guy with a sense of humor. I like to stay up late talking about the big questions. I have a large, irremovable tattoo of the word Chloe on my chest from a previous relationship.
Simon Rich joined us from KQED in San Francisco. His latest book is called The Last Girlfriend on Earth and Other Love Stories. And the book is out this week. Simon, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. For 20 years, George Saunders has been writing short stories. Once a geological engineer who traveled the world, he started crafting wondrous short stories that combined the absurd and fantastic with the mundane realities of everyday life. One story about a professional caveman inspired those iconic Geico commercials. In 2006, he won the MacArthur Fellowship. This month, his new collection of stories came out. It's called 10th of December, and its reception has been nothing short of incredible. Reviewers have raved, and the New York Times Magazine called it, quote, the best book you'll read this year. George Saunders joins me now. George, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, what a reception to this book.
Yeah, it's been a pretty good week.
So let's talk about the craft of the short story, because as I mentioned, you've been working a long time at this. You teach at Syracuse University. Why the short story form?
Well, I kind of have dumb answers. I just find it so beautiful, and I have not figured it out yet. I started maybe in my middle 20s trying to crack at it, and it's just a deep, deep well, you know. So when you get it right, it can be such a beautiful explosion of submerged meaning. So really, I kind of thought, well, I'll work on a few of these and then I'll write a novel. And it's just gone deeper and deeper over the years.
Because there aren't people who may not have read you, let's take a look at your work. And let's take a look at Victory Lap, which introduces us to two teenage characters. One of the things I love about your stories is these are very ordinary people. And we can relate to those people. They then get entangled in very extraordinary circumstances at times. But this is a girl who's imagining herself as a princess, meeting her suitor at a ball, as many young girls do. And her counterpoint here is a skinny boy, a neighbor, terrified of his very strict parents. Let's start by meeting Kyle. His really strict father has left him a work notice.
Sure. A scout, a new geode on deck. Place in yard per included drawing. No goofing. Rake areas first, put down plastic as I've shown you, then lay in white rock. This geode expensive? Please take seriously. No reason this should not be done by time I get home. This is equal to 5 work points. Guard, Dad, do you honestly feel it fair that I should have to slave in the yard until dark after a rigorous cross-country practice that included 16 440s, 8 880s, a mile for time, a kajillion drake sprints, and a 5-mile Indian relay? Shoes off, mister. Yoinks, too late. He was already at the TV. And then left an incriminating trail of microclods. Waver Boten. Could the microclods be hand-plucked? Although problem, if he went back to hand-pluck the microclods, he'd leave an incriminating new trail of microclods. He took off his shoes and stood mentally rehearsing a little show he liked to call What If Right Now? What if they came home right now?
So, George Saunders, this is so delicious because I'm just immediately in Kyle's head with him. And that's not a space that a reader always gets to inhabit with an author. And I was thinking, you've been a geophysicist, and I thought, you know, geode, it's perfect, because so many of your people are under these tectonic pressures of absolute rigidity. The rigidity of mortality, which we're all going to face, debt, which a lot of us face, futility, which I think most people feel at least once a day.
Right. For me, if I think about all those things, I kind of block up. But if I just concentrate on a human voice, I do this thing that I call a third-person ventriloquist, which is it's kind of a standard third-person voice at first, and then as quickly as I can, I try to get into the person's thoughts, but then with the extra kicker of trying to really use slash restrict myself to his or her diction, when you're thinking in someone else's voice, you sort of do become them. So what I'm doing is kind of tapping into a part of me that is a 15-year-old boy, or in this case, a 15-year-old girl. So it gets really psychologically complex. What I found is this technique really makes me love these characters a lot, even when they're kind of messed up or they're doing things that are evil or questionable. Because you're entering the imaginative process through their doorway, it shifts the world a little bit on its axis.
Yeah. Another story in this book, you know, we mentioned a moment ago the way that you burnish your language by using the voice of people who find themselves in over their heads. I'm thinking of the Semplica Girl Diaries. Is that the one that took you 12 years to write?
That is. You know, I dreamed the basic image of the story, which is really disturbing. In the dream, I went to this window in our house and looked out in our yard, and there were these four or five, I knew them to be sort of third world women hanging on a kind of clothesline, and the clothesline actually went through their heads. And I understood these to be kind of lawn ornaments. They had on these beautiful white smocks. Welcome to my dream life. Mm-hmm. But the person I was who was seeing this disturbing image was actually kind of overjoyed and happy at the thing that he should have been disgusted by. I thought, oh my God, I am so lucky. I finally arrived. You know, and it's this feeling of gratitude that I've been able to do this wonderful thing for my family. So I kind of woke up from that dream, and it had some obvious, you know, kind of political, metaphorical implications. And so then the trick for the next 12 years was to kind of preserve the intensity of that first thing without having it just merely be a kind of propagandistic preaching job.
Let's go to a story that I think is really accessible, George. And that would be the title story of this collection, 10th of December. I quite loved it. And I thought, you know, there's almost a 50s feeling in here. This is about a boy who goes into the woods. He's kind of a misfit. He's going to encounter a very sick old man who's thinking about ending his life. And that, to me, is almost classic. Like, I could see Timmy and Lassie come home, and you know, but you've given it a complete, you know, contemporary twist. This is sort of near the end of the story where the little boy, Robin, has been saved, but his savior hasn't. Would you begin there?
Sure. With a shock, he remembered the old guy. What the heck? An image flashed of the old guy standing bereft and blue-skinned in his tighty-whities like a POW abandoned at the barbed wire due to no room on the truck. Or a sad, traumatized stork bidding farewell to its young. He'd bolted. He'd bolted on the old guy. Hadn't even given him a thought. Blimey. What a chicken-ish thing to do. He had to go back. Right now. Help the old guy hobble out. But he was so tired. He wasn't sure he could do it. Well, probably the old guy was fine. Probably he had some sort of old guy plan. But he'd bolted. He couldn't live with that. His mind was telling him that the only way to undo the bolting was to go back now, save the day. His body was saying something else. It's too far. You're just a kid. Get Mom. Mom will know what to do. He stood paralyzed at the edge of the soccer field like a scarecrow in huge flowing clothes.
A sad, traumatized stork bidding farewell to its young, a scarecrow in huge flowing clothes. I think one of the things that really hits me in your language is that it seems simple, but you have such a way with image.
Well, thanks. You know, honestly, so much of this stuff happens on the fly. And for me, one of the deepest pleasures is going into my little writing shed day after day and like, okay, today I have to write that scene where Robin makes a decision. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of waiting for one little detail to come in that will liven it up. Like that stork thing was something that it wouldn't have been a natural thing. I think it would have come after many drafts. You know, when you do interviews, you get a chance to talk about your work. You sort of want to jump to the safety place, which is the concept. Like, yes, well, I do. I often think about image, and image is something that, you know, but mm-hmm. In truth, the real artistic process, as I've understood it, is 95% intuitive, like seat of the pants, at the moment decisions that you can't even explain, you know.
Although again and again and again, which is why it can take 12 years
exactly.
To write a 24-page story.
Exactly. I always compare it to the, you know, the process of if somebody gave you a furnished apartment that they had furnished, your first impression would be, well, thanks, but also this doesn't feel like me. But then if you were allowed to replace one item a day for 7 years with an item that you liked better, after that 7 years, that place would have you all over it in ways that you couldn't have anticipated at the beginning. So likewise, in a story, if you're doing hundreds of drafts and each time you're micro-exerting your taste, that thing is going to start to look more and more and more like you. And in fact, I feel like my stories are much more indicative of me than this guy here talking to you or me on even my best day as a person. The story is a chance to sort of super compress whoever you are and present it in this slightly elevated way.
George Saunders is the author of the new collection, 10th of December. George, it really has been fun. Thank you.
It was a total pleasure. Thank you.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. The scene, Paris in the 20s. There are three women. Esther Murphy, a product of New York high society who wrote madly but could never finish a book. Mercedes DaCosta, an insatiable collector and writer infatuated with Greta Garbo. And Madge Garland, a self-made Australian fashion editor at British Vogue. All are lesbians. Their history burst onto the literary scene this summer in Wesleyan University professor Lisa Cohen's biography. It's called All We Know, Three Lives, and has just been nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Cohen's biography inverts the usual raison d'etre. Though between the three, they knew virtually everybody who was anybody from the 1920s to the 50s, they're not famous. We spoke to Lisa Cohn from Where Else? Paris. She tells us how she came upon these three extraordinary lives.
I first read about Madge Garland in Virginia Woolf's diaries, and I thought, what an extraordinary life. She's intersected with so many people. She was involved with the magazine, with British Vogue magazine in the 1920s when it became a kind of center for art, literature. But somewhere along the way, early on, I realized I encountered these other two women. Mercedes DaCosta I had already heard of. She has a certain notoriety. But Esther Murphy, I'd known her name, but not really taken in her brilliance, her tragedy.
She is the sister of Gerald Murphy, the painter and patron of Léger and Picasso, but she's not like her brother.
Not at all. She's awkward, inelegant, anxious, and absolutely rivetingly brilliant to everyone who meets her. She was intensely voluble and deeply interested in the history of the world and in contemporary politics. She was very close friends with Edmund Wilson when he was young, with the young and just starting out F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Dos Passos, every interesting American writer just about. And it seemed to all of them that Esther would go far.
Did people know that she hadn't actually finished a book?
Everyone knew. Everyone worried. And she went on worrying about herself. That was the idea I had about Esther, that she became a kind of repository of others' anxieties about what it meant to fail and what it meant to succeed.
Let's get to Madge Garland. And she is the self-made one of this group. I mean, she doesn't come from money. And in some ways, I found her the most fascinating. Tell me about her.
She came from a little bit of money. Her father was a successful businessman in the textile business in Australia, and he moved his family to London. But she lost that family connection. She lost that family money when she decided that she wanted to work. She wanted to be a journalist. She was not going to submit to the constraints of her family. She was not going to get married. She was going to go out into the world and learn how to write. And she took what she knew as the daughter of someone who was in the business of selling clothes and accessories and fabrics, and she made that into a career. She became quite a brilliant writer on the history of fashion and on contemporary fashion, on contemporary haute couture.
Mercedes DaCosta, I wanted to know, why did you include her? One of the reviews mentions that she was so beautiful, loved Greta Garbo, was a lover of Greta Garbo's, and slept with every famous girl on the bus between 1900 and 1980.
I included her because she was also a very passionate collector, and I felt that part of what I was doing with this book was thinking about different kinds of archives, the kinds of material that we call evidence that we call biographical evidence. What is a fact? What is the kind of fact that goes into telling someone's life story? And Mercedes de Acosta's and her collection, her very rich collection, which is held at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia, gave me access to a kind of world of passionate collecting and raised very interesting questions about how you tell a life and how these women, in each case, told their own stories, made themselves entirely visible, collected their own documentation about their lives, and yet also rendered themselves invisible in all kinds of ways.
All these women marry briefly, because that's what you do. But I want to ask, how does their lesbianism factor into this entire collection? Why does it matter?
I was interested in showing this world of women that I learned about. It was a world of women who acknowledged their debts to one another. They were intellectual debts and emotional debts and material debts also. And they really depended on one another, and they loved other women. They also sometimes loved other men. But they were committed to these kinds of communities of women. They were committed to supporting other women. Each of these three women knew one another. And I wanted to try to write a book that wasn't just about one great person, but about a kind of collectivity and about these interdependences.
Conversely, why do you think they became rather overlooked?
There's a kind of historical amnesia. Feminism didn't start in the 1970s. It started at least in the teens and 20s. I think that your question is also a question about the genre of biography. And putting these three lives together also forced me to reflect on the genre, on its kind of constraints and its possibilities. And there was a way that each of their lives, as I say about Esther Murphy, both call for biography and suggest the futility of that genre. And I really like that paradox. I like trying to write about what's hard to pin down, what's just out of my reach.
Lisa Cohen, we spoke to her in Paris. She's the author of the new biography, All We Know. You have given us and rescued three remarkable lives, and I'm so very glad that you did. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jackie, for having me.